This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Sue O'Connell.
I'm Peter Kansas. We're in for Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. From the BRA to the NSA, we're kicking things off with local and national politics. From there, we cross over the geopolitical realm by way of Saudi Arabia. Congressman Lynch has made a really gutsy call to Congress to release pages that have been excised from the 9/11 Commission report. Pages that connect, purportedly, Saudi Arabia to the attacks on 9/11. Global Post Charlie Sennett joins us to talk about how the kingdom and our relationship with it has changed since then.
And from there, we dive into Christmas. Jarrett Bowen joins us to give us a consumer's guide to holiday movies. Reverend Irene Monroe breaks down the war on Christmas. And Garen Daly gives us the ultimate behind-the-scenes tour of the Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life. That's next on Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio. It's your lucky day. It's Sue O'Connell and Peter Kansas together again.
At last.
At last.
In the rain.
In the rain I just found out it was Christmas Eve Eve, so now I'm completely freaked out. We're filling in for Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, and joining us in Studio 3 here to go over the local and national politics are Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinocchi and Charlie Chipio of Chipio Strategies. He's also the Director of Policy in the Romney administration. Welcome back. Welcome back to both of you. How are you?
Nice to be here.
So, we're filling in for two people who know something about politics.
That's good. We'll all just keep on. So, the big story that's sort of coming at the end of the year is the story regarding the Boston Redevelopment Authority, the BRA, which if you followed the mayoral race at all, it was a hot topic in every debate and every Q&A, especially from the primaries right up to the final. And there's some news in the BRA about a sweetheart deal that apparently went through toward the end. And Joan, the BRA is one of these crazy quasi-government organizations that doesn't really have very much oversight, if any, except through the mayor's office, which is sort of the kid guarding the candy store in some ways. Can you talk a little bit about this at all? Are you up to speed on the
actual details?
Center?
Why don't you sum up the actual details?
You know, this is
I was doing some last minute Christmas shopping.
Oh, good for you. Well, the BRA staff in 2011 voted unanimously for upscale residences at Millennial Place. And this was a string of some almost 1,492 consecutive board votes, unanimously supporting whatever the staff said. And this is in an article by Sean Murphy in the Globe, BRA cuts deals at expense of affordable housing. And it turns out that a lot of things that were on the table, as some people may not know, that when the BRA approves housing or approves a development, they ask that affordable housing or market rate housing be included. And it seems that some of these things have just been cut off the table and no one knows what's going on with it.
Right. Well, I mean, there are several issues here to sort of throw out on the table. One is just the whole idea that money that was supposed to go to one thing, affordable housing, was apparently diverted to something else. And whether or not that calls for someone to look into it, someone like maybe even the Attorney General, if public money
heaven
is...
Heaven forbid.
You could say, I mean, the administration's or the BRA's response to it was that, well, they did good things or they did other things that the community wanted. But if it's supposed to go to affordable housing and it doesn't, I mean, that does raise questions about the appropriate use of the public's money. The other thing is the secrecy of it and the board of directors, the board of the BRA being so kind of disengaged.
Yes.
And really just rubber stamping. And that was kind of the other thread of this piece, that whatever the mayor asks for, the board basically gives the mayor.
Right.
Without asking questions. And they say, well, the staff has done all the question and answers. But, you know, we should have a higher standard. We should expect more from the board. And I hope that Mayor-elect, soon-to-be Mayor Walsh, does something about it.
And I'm really troubled by that. And I'm biased here because I'm actually working on a book project that is all involved with the history of Boston. And to me, it's very ironic that for years in the 40s and 50s, the big thing about Boston was that Boston essentially had no planning entity, unlike other cities. And now the irony is that we have a planning entity that is so much more powerful than it should be, that the pendulum has clearly swung too far in the other direction. And I think you're right, Sue, what you said at the beginning. Somebody needs to be watching these guys other than the mayor. There's no check on what they do.
Well, you know, there's a lot of interesting secondary issues here. First of all, Sean Murphy did just a terrific job with this story. But he ferreted out more facts than most people know. However, taking nothing away from the specificity of a story, the larger framework has been well known to City Hall insiders for a long time. What struck me as I read the story Sunday is he's talking about these buildings down by, I still call it the Public Garden, boy, I'm so, but you know, the TD, whatever it is.
The Boston Garden.
Those towers were discussed regularly during the campaign, not the specifics of what was going on there, but they were cited as examples. And by the way, I covered a lot of the campaign. I didn't think to ask. I mean, I find it very interesting that days before the mayor leaves office, we sort of get the goods on how it really, how things have really run.
You know, Joan, we haven't had, I was at a party, as many of us have been over the weekend, and we were trying to think about what would be the mark on the Menino, the bad mark on the Menino administration. Certainly there have been issues, the email that disappeared that year, which was an issue of public, who owns the emails. And that always struck me sort of as we're learning how to deal with the email. We might as well take advantage of this loophole moment. But is the BRA in the end, do you think, going to be the issue that 10 years from now, 5 years from now, we look back, hopefully the new administration will clean it up or make it work better, and we're going to look back and go, wow, Menino really had a lockdown on what happened in the city?
I think it has potential to be that. I mean, over the 20 years, the two decades, there certainly have been news reports about how a small group of insiders who are friends of Mayor Menino had the inside track when it came to getting their developments, getting the go-ahead for developments. And if you weren't on the good list, if you were on the naughty list, you were in suspension for those two decades. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think we're going to hear more. It's too bad that it sort of takes the exiting of a mayor to find out the full story.
You'll also see that many of these favored developers will be ponying up large sums of money to Boston University to fund the Urban Institute. Oh, I'm dead serious.
Ponying up money for Walsh.
Did I say Walsh?
I thought you were going to say Walsh.
And that's where Menino's going to be Professor Menino, of course.
I always assume they forget your name as soon as you leave office and they're on to the next guy.
Charlie, if you were advising the administration, the Menino administration, it strikes me as such this duality of the man who is for all this great public housing, how we need more affordable housing. And let me be clear, when we say affordable housing, we're not talking about the lowest possible price.
No.
I mean, I have some friends who have affordable housing in some of these developments, and they're paying $1,800 a month for
this. This is workforce housing.
This is not low income. This is just what in the olden days we would call people moving to the city, How do you square these two things that are coming out? The mayor who wants people in the city to be able to afford to live here, and developers who apparently are able to not fulfill their promises for affordable housing.
I just think that, over time, people who are in power and who I would say are decent people. I mean, I don't think Tom Menino comes into this trying to do the wrong thing or anything like that. But I think over time, you convince yourself that these developers that you're close with, that you trust, that you think are going to do the right thing, I think you convince yourself by doing these things, it's the right thing to do. And I think it's just a classic example of what happens when one person is in power for a long time. I don't think it's anything that's new to Tom Menino.
Right. I mean, the plus side of it is Menino has the Menino legacy is that he's leaving a city in good economic shape.
Yes.
Kind
yes.
of a building boom that's been heralded and much discussed and talked about, and that you have to have flexibility. You just can't. You have to let developers, sort of
yep.
manipulate things a little bit. So you give a little, you get a little. But as you said, Sue, I mean, affordable housing supposedly has been his goal. And if he somehow took his eye off the ball or let people divert money from where it was supposed to go, it's not yep. right.
And if this BRA stuff becomes as big in terms of his legacy as we all think that it might, I think that the great sort of collector's item in all this is going to be that thing he did for Mass Inc. a couple of years ago when he did the Saturday Night Live kind of skit where he's there with the cat talking to Chiafaro.
Like he was the godfather. Yeah. That's funny.
But, you know, for the Walsh administration, I would find it hard to believe that John Barros, assuming he's going to have a role in the administration.
Who was the candidate for mayor also.
Right. And ditto Felix Arroyo. These would be facts known to both of them as well.
But you get the feeling that Walsh is backing away from his BRA.
Yeah, no, he absolutely
and
is.
And that's unfortunate.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, I think what's hitting Walsh right now
is reality.
But I'm not being snarky. Is the totality, the hugeness of the job that confronts him. And listen, this is largely, this isn't a structural matter. You know, you could rebuild the BRA any number of ways, but the mayor can play it any way he or someday she would want to play it. Right. It's all a matter of just having, I think, a handful of transparent rules and having the guts and the intestinal fortitude to follow through on them.
I think Walsh deserves a little bit of a break right now. Mm-hmm. He hasn't even
been sworn in. Yeah.
I mean, if no one says, or I don't think he has to blow up the BRA on day one. He said he's looking for 6 months or whatever to kind of assess and sort of figure out what to do. And I don't think that's a terrible thing.
Nope, that's
no,
fine.
It makes a lot of sense.
We're going to move over to Washington, D.C., where we've got some news down there as well. The White House, this reported by the New York Times, the White House tries to prevent judge from ruling on surveillance efforts. Shock of all shocks, there's gambling here. it seems that as early as 2001, the NSA, the National Security Agency, had begun systematically collecting data about Americans' emails and phone calls, along with its program of wiretapping certain calls without warrants. So, you know, I mean, Peter, it seems that our recent ire of discovery seems to be a little late here, that the horse has already left the barn 10 years ago.
But the judge that ruled this is, you know, verboten, or should be verboten, who, interestingly enough, is a conservative Republican judge who ruled that this NSA stuff is very bad business. His ruling vindicates Snowden because Snowden said that he had released this information secure in the knowledge, or words to that effect, secure in the knowledge that the courts would someday find this level of monitoring intrusive.
So, well, Charlie Chippio, is Snowden a whistleblower now? Has he moved into the whistleblower land? I mean, because a big criticism, as Peter said, was that he didn't, you know, go through the channels that one, it wasn't the big, but one of them, he didn't go through the channels, the legal channels, in order to get this information out. It seems if he had, this is what would have happened. So is he a whistleblower?
Well, maybe he is. I got to tell you, I'm as sort of flummoxed by all this as a lot of people are. I've been shocked by the whole thing. I think maybe he ought to go to Washington because what Peter said is right. I mean, he talked about the judge being a Bush appointee. If you look at this, case that they're trying to prevent the judge from ruling on, both the plaintiffs are right wingers. This guy has somehow managed to bring together, you know, these entities that no one else in Washington can seem to bring together. But this is clearly, an immense problem. And I actually, Joan, I think you really hit on it in one of your recent columns, this whole idea. This is a classic case of where the law is just hopelessly behind the technology. Mm-hmm. And so we don't as a result, we don't know what the rules are. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I feel about it. I don't know what to say about it.
Well, I don't want to take credit for that because it was the judge that you're talking about, Judge Leon, who actually wrote that in his opinion.
Yes.
Besides being a Bush appointee, he also is a local guy. He grew up in West Natick. He went to Holy Cross, and he is a graduate of Suffolk Law School.
And he clerked for a Rhode Island judge.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really is an interesting story. I don't get this whole thing from the Obama administration. It seems like they were trying to out-Bush Bush.
Yeah.
And
like with the drones.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, he was trying to get cover from – I just don't understand the whole philosophy behind what they were doing. And I hope that people get collectively outraged.
Well,
because
Joan,
it just seems like – I never understood why Snowden wasn't seen as a whistleblower slash – hero.
Well, this is what I mean. If I try and put myself as a regular person for a minute, that's been all whipped up over abortion and gay marriage and all these other what we call wedge issues and unimportant issues, but they're important to people, you know, on both sides, obviously. But we spend all this time listening to our candidates and our national elected officials talking about these things when underneath it all we have this almost sinister spying on Americans and German chancellors.
Right.
And folks are just now, I think, to their own credit. I mean, it's not because they're ignorant or stupid. They're just human beings living a real life, are suddenly realizing this. And I wonder, and this is by in no means a defense of Obama on this issue, but it goes back to that old war horse. You walk into the White House and you see what the heck's going on. And it's like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
You know, am I really going to be the guy that says we're spying on everybody?
Yeah.
You know?
But he continued it. I mean, so I do hold him accountable. And to a large degree, this is the legacy of 9/11 in that American citizens started balancing national security against privacy and deciding to give a little on privacy. But the question is, how much do you want to give? Do you want to give everything?
No, but what is interesting is that within the Bush administration, real conservatives, I don't mean right-wing nuts, I mean real conservatives fought back against Bush, including his own quite conservative attorney general. And they repeatedly said there's a limit beyond which we can't go. And what so impressed me about this judge is we tend to think of all Republicans as being, you know, these crazy right-wing people. They're not. There are very conservative people, but who are very serious about what they do. What ticks me off about this NSA stuff is you've got gazillions of bureaucrats pushing around elected officials. And why the elected officials, especially someone as smart as Obama, or allegedly as smart as Obama, don't just say, hey, cut it out, guys. Knock it off. Draw the line. You know, this court decision is based on a ruling by Judge Learned Hand from 1950, where the federal government convicted some low-level person of, you know, turning secrets over to the Russians. And Judge Hand said, well, wait a second.
By carrier pigeon.
You know, and they was top secret, but they weren't very important. And he, too, got a lot of heat when he overturned and said, look, we set this person up. We had no warrants. We gave her no due process. This is not any way to run a country, even if what she did is wrong. So here's a conservative judge who took this narrow decision and had the sense to apply it to what we're doing in Washington.
You know, I thought one of the most interesting, powerful lines in the judge's decision was just the uselessness of the information that was gathered.
Oh.
He said the government couldn't cite one example where it actually prevented anything bad from happening.
Yep. So, no, that's right. And I think Peter's right. I think you're right what you're saying, too, about this sort of the government being run by the bureaucrats. I mean, this was JFK's great lesson right after the Bay of Pigs.
Right.
I mean, it's an important lesson for these guys to learn.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Sue O'Connell, along with Peter Kadzis, and for Jim and Marjorie. We've got Joan Vernocchi, who's a columnist for the Boston Globe, and Charlie Chippio, who runs Chippio Strategies here. And we're just talking about some of the things in the news as we head to the year. And, of course, the sort of daily news is whether or not we'll actually have casinos here and where they will be. News coming out of Revere is that Revere looks like we've entered a partnership with the latest casino of the day, and what will happen with East Boston, and is it going to be Mohegan Sun, and who's, you know, it's a very difficult story to keep track of. I mean, Peter, how many casinos do you think we now had in the mix, and who's which town is going where, and what's happening in Nantucket? I mean, what about Martha's Vineyard?
And what about the Indians?
What about,
my mind boggles, but I'll tell you, something really disturbed me this morning. Mm-hmm. I just thought, for the fun of it, to do a general search to see what came up right away when I looked at casinos this morning. Now, you search today and you'll get something different. I uncovered right away a study from the Wharton School in Pennsylvania, a detailed business study on how to find the best customer, how casinos can attract their best customers. The definition of a best customer is someone who loses the most money.
Yeah.
I know why we're worrying about this, but there's something really pretty perverse about the twists and turns that are taking place here.
But Peter, you know, this is the part. I grew up in Revere. I think my grandmother was a bookie. You know, I lived right between exactly the same distance between Wonderland and Suffolk Downs. You know, and the fact that the state plays the lottery, runs the lottery, is now the bookie, and the state itself is you know, the biggest members of participants are the poor. You go to any, you know, except when Powerball, I'll go in and play a dollar Powerball. But, you know, at the same time, it's generating money back to the cities. We could talk in towns. We could talk about whether or not that's worth it or not. It's almost impossible, I think, to take the argument that it's a moral issue.
I'm not saying it's a moral issue.
It's preying on.
Why prey on more people and make it even easier for them to lose money? And I'd rather have the state be the bookie than some of these characters that we've seen come before the Gaming Commission.
No offense to your grandmother.
No, that would be an accurate description.
She had a job. She wasn't on welfare.
Yeah,
she had a job.
Actually, she was on welfare. It was 1950.
Driving a Cadillac, wearing a mink coat.
But I mean, you know, so what, Charlie,
But the other piece of this is that what we're going to get, all this revenue, is it's illusory. It's not going to be there, okay? And I mean, the thing I'm with, when I read all these stories and watch all this stuff, the only thing I keep saying to myself is I can't wait to wake up in November and go to the voting booth and vote to undo this whole thing.
I'm with you on that. I hope it makes it to the ballot.
Yeah.
Right
sure
now,
do.
If
I
it
will.
So. The SJC has to rule on it.
You know, I see a Revere Beach the way that we were always told. You know, I was born in 1961 when it was changing from what this great vacation
You're a child.
A baby. And, you know, we would go, and I actually thought an insurance fire was a type of fire growing up because, like, something would burn down and the folks would say, oh, that was an insurance fire. And I'd go, wow, I can't even tell. But, you know, there's this vision of Suffolk Downs becoming what Revere wants their beach to be.
But it's
again
not what East Boston wants it to be.
No.
And I just think it's a complete perversion of how this whole proposal started out. And the idea that this state could support three casinos plus the two slots, parlors, whatever they're called, it's too much.
It is. I mean, the business plan to it, Charlie, is really remarkable. I mean, I'm just shocked that you look at any of the nearby casinos, you know, Twin River, which a report came out today, their money's gone. They've seen a drop.
Foxwoods,
if you go out to Foxwoods, it's just dreary and not really like the commercials. And Mohegan Sun is doing well, and they also bringing in top acts though for musics. And you know, you can go drop the kids off to see Demi Lovato and then go play some slots while the kids are in the concert. But I can't see it as a viable business plan.
No, I don't either. And the only other thing, the only one of those things I've ever been to is Mohegan Sun. I actually had a conference once at Mohegan Sun. And I was leaving the conference, and I was sitting there just having a piece of pizza before I went to my car. And in comes a guy, you know, on the walker, you know, with the respirator, you know, like ordering, you know, trying to go through change to order himself a donut for dinner, you know. And I mean, and you say you can't make a moral argument about this stuff. I think you can in terms of saying, you know, government does some things that maybe they shouldn't do, but boy, to make it this much worse on this big a scale, I think you can make a more argument against that.
Here's what I think, and by the way, I may be wrong, but my prediction is that if it makes it to the ballot. They'll get the signatures, but if the court allows it to go forward, everything will be put on hold for several months. And that's probably not bad, because whether we like it or not, all sorts of kinks will be worked out. But I think if the polls continue to hold the way they hold now, gambling would be reaffirmed, because most people, when they're asked, favor it. But then when they have to vote on it in their own backyard or nearby, they don't want it. Well, and I don't know if that changes.
I may be wrong on this, too. So we'll see who turns out to be right or wrong if it does make it to the ballot. But I think there's a chance that a repeal question could pass in Massachusetts, that the last year has pulled back the curtain so that people who might have said, oh, well, you're just pointing out the worst possible scenario and it's not going to be like that, have seen kind of a
shady, sleazy
kind of.
You mean words like Russian mobster?
they see the truth, that there is truth behind what the critics say. And it's not just that you don't want it in your backyard, but if you're in East Boston or if you're in an adjoining community, it's not just Revere. It's going to spill through and impact you. And I think people have a better sense of that.
Joan, River. And,
yeah, no, I agree with you. It would also be interesting if one of the candidates for governor, you know, embraces the repeal.
Well, one has.
Repeal.
Charlie Baker already has. And he said maybe one casino in Massachusetts, which I think makes more sense than three.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Joan, you had a column about the bombing, the questions about the Marathon bombing and the FBI, which, you know, we talk a lot about here at Boston Public Radio. And again, this is another one of those issues that I get concerned that the general public isn't latched onto the way that those of us in the news media. Your column, More Bombing Questions for FBI, December 22nd, about some of the information that the Globe, which has been doing some tremendous pieces over the past 2 weeks, if anyone's taken some time off from reading the Boston Globe, the past 2 weeks are really showing, I think, what
Tsarnaev profile was incredible.
Incredible. The Children's Hospital profile, just some great, great work. So 2014 is going to be a great year for the Globe, I predict. But, you know, there's stuff that happened. And during the bombing investigation, prior, after, what happened with the shooting in Watertown? And we're not getting any answers to it. And you strike the tone that it's not about blame, but it's about what happened. How do we keep it from happening? What happened that was right? What happened that was wrong? And let's close it up and move forward. You know, our friend Chris Ferrone from The Dig says we're not going to have answers about this for at least 10 years. This is kind of the Kennedy assassination investigation. What's your take on that?
Well, I guess I kind of agree with that. Maybe I don't think it's as big as the Kennedy assassination, but Congressman Bill Keating has really been the one who continues to ask questions. He's on the Committee for Homeland Security, and he says that they're going to have a report out in early 2014 that will, at least I think from what he says, address some of the issues that have been raised about information sharing between federal agencies. But I have my doubts that we ever really will have anybody taking any kind of accountability for what could have been done better. And there's been a lot of turnover. The head of the FBI is gone. The head of Homeland Security is gone. Ed Davis is gone as police commissioner. It's kind of this, to use an overused term, perfect storm of people disappearing and exiting. Right. And will we get answers? And will anybody be held accountable?
And I think everybody also has, like reporters, everybody has a little bit of information that they really can't confirm enough to report.
Yep.
You know, and I mean, I have two pieces of information that I keep sharing with folks. And they're like, yeah, that happened, but we can't confirm it. You know, so it almost like it's just going to go right into a black hole.
Well, we don't need the federal government to investigate this. By the way, I'm not Congressman Keating is on the right track, but this was essentially a local manifestation of terror that was handled pretty well at the local level, with some examples of too much exuberance and lack of coordination. You know, the city of Boston, the city council, which always wants more authority, could hold its own hearing. But then again, you know, the people you know, would they dare question the police department? By the way, I'm not suggesting there's anything. Most of this took place in Cambridge and Watertown, however, and it's pretty clear that the biggest problem was the number of off-duty officers who swarmed into the area. There's nothing preventing the State House from holding a hearing.
Right. Governor Patrick's been remarkably uncurious, if that's a word.
Yeah. And so, apathetic.
And so has Martha Coakley.
Yeah.
I mean, she passed on this, too.
They don't because it's an election year.
Yeah.
They're afraid of public employee unions, in this case.
Well,
the
they
state
also don't want to. I mean,
police.
I think the problem also with like attorney generals when they're in elective office is they don't want to cast a bad eye on officials, firemen and police officers who are responding, even if it's not in a critical way, just in a how do we make this better.
But that's not a good reason.
No,
not
it isn't.
It
isn't.
Listen, you get someone like Mike Dukakis, the former governor, you ask him to form a 2 or 3 member committee and say, look, we want you to give us just a 15-page report about, and the report can say, individual public safety people did a great job. However, moving forward, here are 5 key areas that need to be, it can be addressed.
So, Charlie, the Obama administration and Barack Obama finishing up the year, like the rest of us. Unlike the rest of us, though, we don't have to give a speech every January laying out what we'd like to do, you know, and talking about some of the highlights we'd like to hit. And Obama, of course, has delivered on his marriage equality with the striking down of DOMA, which was from the Supreme Court, but his support of it and action. And we're seeing that in the surprise in Utah on Friday just started getting same-sex couples started getting married. But it's been a really tough year for him on just about every other area. I know it's early in the term, you know, that they've got the turnaround guys come in to hope that the legacy word gets honored. But, you know, where's Obama go from here other than he can't go down? Can he go down?
I think he certainly can go up. I mean, if you go back, you know, those of us who are old enough remember, you know, that, you know, after the whole Iran-Contra thing, Reagan's numbers were down and, you know, he got a new chief of staff in. He managed to turn it around in the sense of that he left on a high note with very high approval ratings and all that. And, you know, Obama certainly can do the same thing. I mean, if I were him, I would certainly be focusing on an improving economy, bring more attention to that. And doing whatever you can to sort of try to make this whole healthcare thing work, which I can't claim to understand at all because I don't. But clearly that has been a huge drag on his numbers.
Well, John, I think that the healthcare thing actually will end up just being a blip now that the website's mostly working and folks are mostly getting insured. But there are some other major issues this year that he's just not going to shake off.
Well, I was going to say on the healthcare thing, I mean, he's kind of delayed just about everything in terms of penalties and everything.
Yeah.
And I mean, if people continue to sign up or if they sign up in the numbers that they need, the last fall, what happened in the last fall will be a blip, or at least the Republicans will try not to make it a blip, but the people will accept it. I don't know how he goes forward with an agenda. I mean, how he makes anything that he wants to happen. Let's put it this way. I'm glad I don't have to figure that out.
I mean, Peter, it's a tough road to go forward. I mean, is there any low-hanging fruit left for him? I mean, it's, as we've talked about earlier, too, the being more Bush than Bush on a number of issues.
Hasn't worked out too well for him.
Well, no, and the prognosis for the midterm elections is pretty grim at the moment. And I'm not talking about the House, I'm talking about the Senate, where there is a very, very reasonable case that the Republicans could gain 6 seats in the Senate. And that's just because of red states where there are re-election. This has no way to blame Obama for this. Obama could be blamed if the Democrats don't do better in the House, but the Senate situation is much more structural. Now, it's too early to say, but imagine the nightmare. Forget Obama, but I would think the nightmare for the country with the Republican Party controlling the Senate and the House. No, it's tough for Obama. I mean, it's tough.
But I think who are those candidates going to be and what kind of campaigns are they going to run? Because I think you got to also remember the amount of self-inflicted damage that the Republicans.
Yeah, that's what I was going to.
I mean,
it's
it's a real sort of a pox on all their houses kind of view that I think a lot of voters have right now. Maybe it's different in some really red states, but I think for the vast majority of the American public, I think we've sort of had enough of these, you know, sort of Tea Party candidates and talking about, you know, women who can't get pregnant if they're raped and, you know, and all, you know.
Well, there is no doubt that the Democrats' secret weapon turns out always to be the Republicans.
I mean, the Tea Party in particular.
The Tea Party in particular.
I was just say, you mentioned the Senate, you know, what could happen in the Senate, and I thought that would be a good segue for Scott Brown in New Hampshire.
Yep.
And the conventional wisdom seems to be that it's he's on a fool's mission, he could never sell himself in New Hampshire, and he's not conservative enough, and he's a carpetbagger and all that. But I don't know, maybe he can repackage himself as the Scott Brown Republican.
I don't know. David Bernstein, and this is David's thesis, David has been saying that he thinks this is less about the Senate. He won't dismiss the Senate there, but that
president, he
thinks it's testing the waters for president. You know, you've got Chris Christie, who is hot at the moment, but crazier things have happened. And all the money he's going to make at his new law firm, he's not taxed as much.
Well, wait, go ahead, Charlie. Final word.
I think one of the things about that is that, a lot of Republicans have said, well, you know, we've had this president who only had 4 years in the Senate. He wasn't prepared. He didn't have the experience. I don't know how a guy who's only had 2 years in the Senate makes the case that he's going to run for president.
You're being too logical.
Chris Christie has actually run something, state.
Good point.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Charlie Chipio from Chipio and Consultants and Joan Vinocchi from the Boston Globe. Lots coming up in 2014. We're looking forward to it. When we come back, we're going to talk some more about politics here on Boston Public Radio, WGBH.
Christmas afternoon, podcaster Mark Maron talks with Mel Brooks.
You seem to have a very strong attraction to musical comedy.
I can give you the minute it happened. It burst, in my brain, and I said, no, I don't want to be a shipping clerk at Rosenthal and Slotnick.
The Mark Maron Marathon, Christmas Day, starting at noon, right here.
89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Museum of Science, where you can bring your intellectual appetite to our global kitchen. You'll learn that the food you eat connects you to people and places you've never known. Now on exhibit. More at mos.org/globalkitchen. And Northeastern University, where researchers are creating sophisticated computer programs to put the world's cyber criminals out of business. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Sue O'Connell with Peter Katsas, sitting in for Marjorie and Jim here. Happy Christmas, happy holidays.
Ho, ho, ho.
That's very exciting. You know, when Michael Moore released his documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11, most people thought it was one of those big lefty conspiracy theory things, and particularly Moore's claims that Saudi Arabian government officials that were directly linked to the terrorist attacks. But now, a decade later, it looks like Moore may have been onto something. United States Reps Walter Jones and our own Stephen Lynch have read a redacted portion of the 9/11 Commission report, and they're shocked at the level of foreign state involvement in the attacks, since they can't reveal the nation identified in the report without violating federal law. They're asking Congress to pass a resolution to declassify the entire 2002 report. Some information has already been leaked, and it points back to Saudi Arabia. Joining us on the line to go over these developments and remind us how much Saudi Arabia has changed since 2001 is Charlie Sennett. Charlie Sennett is the vice president and co-founder of GlobalPost.com. Charlie, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Hey, Charlie, how are you?
Very good. How are you? Sounds good. Like someone's got a cold.
And it just started up this second. Listen, you know,
okay.
Steve Lynch is one of the few members of Congress who's read the 28 pages that were suppressed in the 9/11 report.
We're going to take a listen to that right now.
Transparency is the way to go. Not just because of the value in that, of having this information out there. Remember, there was a very extensive report, the 9/11 report, hundreds and hundreds of pages, but these 28 pages were actually excised from that report. So these are not, these are not just redactions. The 28 pages that I read and that Walter Jones read have actually been pulled from the report completely.
So, Charlie, there you have Stephen Lynch, our congressman here, really shocked at something that he read in the report. This is sort of unprecedented in recent times.
It is. You know, I feel a little bit like, remember the scene in Casablanca?
Right.
when they say, we're shocked, sir, to see that there's gambling going on here. And then they say, you're winning, sir.
Right.
I think Casablanca is not a bad metaphor for the murky, shadowy morality of our relationship for a very long time with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, always described as a staunch U.S. ally, put forth a brand of very, very conservative, very, very much an extremist version of Islam, known as Wahhabism or Salafi Islam, and preached it all over the region, all through their schools, and it dovetailed quite a bit with a very strong anti-Western message that's been increasingly intensified, many would say warped, and you know. I don't think any of us should be surprised that there's going to be some element of collusion coming out of some elements of the Saudi government with those members who later would form al-Qaeda. It's just there as a Rorschach drawing if you want to see it for a very long time. And I want to just remind the Boston audience that you know, when I was Middle East Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, the Globe gave me a great assignment, and they asked me right after 9/11. I was in Afghanistan, and I came back in February, and they said, "Where do you want to go? You know, next?" And I said, "We got to go to Saudi Arabia." And to the Globe's credit, they funded a big investigative report in Saudi Arabia, where we uncovered that, if you remember, 12 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. And what we uncovered was that 15 of the 19
right.
were Saudis. But what we uncovered was that 12 of those 15 Saudis all came from one highway that leads in the Asir province, right up to the border of Yemen. This is very much the tribal homeland of bin Laden, right on the Yemeni-Saudi border. His father, the construction magnate, who was very close to the palace, to the House of Saud, all from that area. These were all prominent families that are very much a part of an elite that is not necessarily pure royalty, not necessarily members of the House of Saud, but very connected to it. And the theory then was that the recruitment pattern of 12 young men on one strip of road that bin Laden knew well because his father built that road, there was some suggestion that bin Laden himself, Osama bin Laden himself, had worked on that road through his father's very large construction company, and that they were very intentionally recruiting and selecting prominent Saudi families, not poor, disenfranchised youth, but prominent, established families and the scions of those families, so that they could send a message that the attack of 9/11 really was about a sort of a Saudi establishment, if not government, message.
But Charlie,
the United States.
What I remember in 2001 was the sort of mixed messages that I wasn't really actively in any way covering covering it. But as a sort of quasi layperson, I remember this mixed message of, you know, they might have been from Saudi Arabia, but it wasn't a Saudi Arabian attack. You know, that we are so concerned about Saudi Arabia that we may or may not have helped Saudi Arabians leave America right after the attack. Mm-hmm. That there was this.
I don't think it would be fair to categorize it as a Saudi attack any
right.
more than it's fair to categorize it as an Afghanistan attack.
But I think
remember,
that
Al-Qaeda
right.
is a grouping of many different, mostly Arab nationalities and different militants from all over the region who came together precisely to consider the United States an enemy. That is the idea of al-Qaeda. So just as it was wrong to think that the plot al-Qaeda formed through being given cover in Afghanistan by the Taliban government, that that's an Afghani attack, it's just as wrong as it would be to think it's a Saudi attack. It's an al-Qaeda attack.
But what I think happened
is who gave cover.
Right. And what I think what happened with that narrative, though, was that it buried the Saudi Arabia part of it to me. You know what I mean? That I know it wasn't a Saudi Arabian attack, but they were almost shielded from any sort of coverage of it. That's just my layperson sort of remembrance of 2001.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an understandable point of view. I think a lot of people felt that way, and that's why the Globe sent me there to really look at it. You know, we really got undercover there, and at great risk, I have to say. I mean, we did not have approval to go find these families on that highway, and we were very much operating there. And the government was quite angry that I had broken away from the government minders and gotten out on the road. But meeting these families, going into the schools in that area, hearing their militancy, the acceptance that bin Laden, that what bin Laden did, America may have deserved, hearing that in Saudi Arabia was quite jarring.
See, Chuck,
me as an American, and I think for our
it's interesting, as I was rereading that Globe series this morning in preparation for the show, I was really struck by the part about the schools. And,
yeah.
My larger concern, though, is how, and I'm asking this neutrally, how relevant are the concerns in the wake of 9/11 today? How much has Saudi Arabia changed? Has it changed enough? I've been amazed that, you know, Congressman Lynch, Steve's by Democratic standards somewhat conservative, but you've got a, you know, good old lefty fellow traveler journalist like Joe Connison, you know, really playing up the fact that Lynch is raising these questions. It's an unusual marriage, if you will.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very important that Congressman Lynch raised these questions. They're very important questions to ask, and we've waited way too long to ask them, and we haven't put forward enough pressure on the government to yield some answers on it. To try to get to your question about what is Saudi Arabia like now and how much has it changed, you know, I went back to Saudi Arabia with an amazing Global Post correspondent we had in Riyadh for a long time, Massachusetts resident as well. Her name is Carol Murphy. Pulitzer Prize winner for the Washington Post, working for the Global Post in Riyadh for about 3 years. She's probably the smartest person I know on Saudi Arabia. Carol and I traveled back in to study the country again, and I went back out on the same road I traveled in 2002, looking at those schools and looking at where the recruitment of the hijackers came from. And I was struck that Saudi had changed a lot. There really was profound change. The militancy, the open expression of anti-American sentiment, the open expression of the extremism of the Wahhabi culture was much more muted. It was nowhere near as visible. And I think whether that's veneer or real would be hard for me to say, because it's a very difficult country to understand, a very complex one. But I certainly think there was profound change. And we were there right at the time when women were taking chances with driving, and you know, you heard so much about change there and about a slow sense of movement forward. I think 9/11 was a wake-up call for Saudi Arabia, too, that the spirit of vitriol, I think we could call it that they were putting forward through some of the teaching, had erupted in enormous and violence that most Saudis would never support or condone.
We're speaking with Charlie Sennett. He's the vice president and co-founder of GlobalPost.com. Charlie, what happens now going forward with Congressman Lynch and their hope to make public some of this removed data? Do you think it it has a chance, and how long would it take, do you think?
I don't know how long it would take. I think it has a chance. I think it's time for answers. I think we all need to understand better the forces that came together to create the really dark force of al-Qaeda, and the extent to which there are some lessons for us to learn about how we carry ourselves as a country in the world that we should examine, never to suggest that somehow you know, I don't know, there was this great feeling reaction to anyone who would suggest that we had something somehow to do with the creation of Al-Qaeda, because we actually supported bin Laden, of course. Everyone remembers that history. We supported bin Laden in the war in Afghanistan, in which the Afghan Mujahideen, or freedom fighters, were fighting the Soviets, and bin Laden was part of that. Many of the elements of Al-Qaeda came together out of that conflict, and we, of course, supported the Mujahideen and supported bin Laden in his efforts against the Soviets. Now there's a much more sophisticated set of questions to ask in the aftermath of what lessons are there for us to learn. How have we, on some level, may have even fomented extremism through our support for the Saudis, an unquestioning support driven by our relationship over oil? These are questions that were asked, I think, a little bit recklessly by some like, you know, members of the media. I think Michael Moore's documentary was strong, but I think it was a little bit loose around the edges. Mm-hmm. I think there are hardcore questions we need to know the answers to, and I hope Steve Lynch keeps on pressing for them. And I know that at Global Post, we're going to keep covering Saudi Arabia and trying to look at that very hard and harsh light.
Charlie, in the larger context, the issue that strikes me is the widespread instability throughout all of the Midwest. Mideast. And, you know, the sort of stalemate with Iran, which might unravel about nuclear weapons, the disintegration of Syria. Would a further inquiry into the Saudi involvement in 9/11 actually serve a fruitful purpose? Or wouldn't it inflame American
opinion? I think truth
opinion?
Always serves a fruitful purpose. I think it was one of the biggest things that we let ourselves down as the media in the lead up to the Iraq war, that we didn't go after harder answers and dig deeper for truth. I think truth always serves the interest. I think that's the whole job we have as journalists, is to go after that. Syria is a tinderbox, and Syria is becoming a proxy war for the Sunni Middle East, largely supported by the Saudis and, frankly, the West, and then the Syrian regime, largely supported by the Shia, Iran, and Russia being behind that axis. There's a real danger of a regional conflagration in Syria breaking down along sectarian lines, and Saudi Arabia would potentially play a very prominent role in that, as would Iran. I think we have to be very careful of all of the chemical combinations that are swirling right now in the Middle East. They're quite fraught with peril, and we need to proceed in a sophisticated and cautious way where we really look deep and work hard to understand what's at work in the region. Make sure we make good policy decisions. These are fateful moments for our State Department. John Kerry is well-equipped as Secretary of State. I think he really does have a handle on the complexity of what's out there, but I don't envy him, because these are very hard questions. And I have to ask you to forgive me, because I need to run. We have an office party here. I'm sure many of your listeners are doing the same
well,
thing.
Well, since I was
and
coughing.
I need to run, because I got hungry staffers looking in on me. When are we going to start?
And I was almost choking to death, so
oh,
that's only
go.
Fair.
Happy holidays. Hey, Charlie, thanks so much for
Merry
joining
Christmas,
us.
Happy holidays, and Happy New Year to all. I hope 2014 brings a lot of new developments in the Middle East, a lot of good things in the works for diplomacy. Let's hope they work.
Good message there, Charlie. Thanks so much, and happy holidays to your staff. Charlie Sennett is the vice president and co-founder of GlobalPost.com. When we get back, we're diving into Christmas. Arts reporter Jared Bowen joins us for a consumer's guide to this season's movies. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The Federal Reserve turns 100 years old this month, and you know what? We almost didn't get there.
We came late, we Americans, to the notion that we needed a central bank.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Nothing better than partying with a bunch of central bankers, huh? We'll have that story and the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you and the Skating Club of Boston. The U.S. Figure Skating Championships come to the TD Garden January 5th through 12th. Winners go on to represent Team USA at the Olympic Games in Russia. You can visit Boston2014.com. And Inspector George Gently. Martin Shaw stars as the hard-bitten detective who must cope with murder, crime, and changing times in the 60s. Don't miss Inspector George Gently, Monday at 9 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Sue O'Connell with Peter Kadzis. We're sitting in for Jim and Marjorie. Isn't it exciting, Peter?
Yeah, I sort of feel like I'm in a fairy tale here.
Yes, isn't it? Like a dream come true for us. We've known each other a very long time. His wife has always wanted this to happen. It's a whole nother path, but we'll talk about that later. Here in the studio with us, Studio 3, is arts reporter Jared Bowen with his guide to holiday movie going. Hello.
I'm sorry to interrupt this little moment that you two are having. Should I step out?
No, please come in.
You got here just in time. A little more eggnog for Sue.
Yeah, I know, right. So, you know, this is the great movie going season, of course. I heard a great piece on NPR over the weekend of what are you doing differently for the holidays, and this woman called in, a single mom. Her daughter is 23 and, you know, finally said, I can't come home for the holidays, and you're expecting a wah-wah. And instead she said, and that's great because I can go to the movies for 2 days. I don't have to put the tree up. But it's a great movie-going time. So
I know families who strategically plan their movie-going. You know, they coordinate the whole day so that they don't just see one, but they bounce from one to the next. Paying, of course, stopping in the middle to pay.
Of course, yes, of course. Yeah. No, it's a great day. So what's the top? Should I start at the top or just you have a list? Are they in order?
We have a list, but I have to say that I think my number one movie of the year has just come out. It's American Hustle.
Yes.
I mean, first of all, I have to back up and say that this has been a fantastic movie year, I think. And especially this fall. Fall is always a great time because this is when you're getting all of the Oscar movies. So you're getting great performances anyway. There's been very little that I haven't liked. We're getting so many, I think, really novel films, different types of filmmaking, and really terrific performances. Mm-hmm. And American Hustle, I have to say, is probably my favorite.
Let's take a listen to a clip, American Hustle, directed by David O. Russell.
I want to show you something. This Rembrandt here. People come from all over the world to see this.
Yeah, he's good, yeah.
It's a fake.
It's impossible.
People believe what they want to believe. The guy who made this was so good that it's real to everybody. Now, who's the master? The painter or the forger?
Now, I love this movie. I haven't seen it yet. I already love it because it was shot in the South End of Boston. So you can actually see Washington Street and Foodies Market, which does not look like Foodies Market. And this was my era. You know, this is when I was going to nightclubs, and I think I dressed just like they did.
Just like Amy Adams, you had necklines plunging down to your ankles?
Yes, I did. I remember going to dinner with my boyfriend in high school, and I had on a shirt. Just a shirt is probably an overstatement. But, you know, so it just looks like it captures exactly what was happening. And the Abscam, that's the name of it, right?
The Abscam scandals,
Which was the reality part
it was,
of this.
It was an unfortunate fashion moment.
Well, say you.
Well, this is so fun because you take a big 70s bath. You just dive right in. And as you said, between the costumes and the real-life scandal, I mean, although the text at the top of the movie says some of this actually happened.
Yeah.
But this is this great comedic caper from David O. Russell. It's extremely funny. You have this overzealous, overly permed FBI agent in Bradley Cooper who's so power hungry. He wants to make a name for himself. So he gets these cons, Christian Bale and Amy Adams, to help him participate in a con to bring down all of these great politicians in Jersey who are about to build Atlantic City. And of course, they're not doing it in the most politically correct or legislatively correct way,
right.
I should say. And of course, nothing's politically correct about this film either. But what is so amazing about it is you get this great script, this great directing, and then you have these really, really delicious performances by Bradley Cooper and Christian Bale and Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner.
And what a lineup, though. I mean, that just like Amy Adams and Jennifer
Lawrence
seem like they can do no wrong.
They
are able to inhabit these characters. And I know I saw a clip, of course, and Amy Adams' character actually has inhabits characters within the film as well.
She does, yes. Yeah, she takes on this whole persona of a lady from England, and so she's fooling everybody in that regard. And I have to say, I saw a little bit of her. I haven't seen the entire film, this new film that's coming out Christmas Day with Joaquin Phoenix. Amy Adams is in that too. And it's fascinating, just to your point, that it's great to watch her in this film where she's sort of this meek, hapless woman, and then see her as this sex pot in American Hustle.
Right. I still can't get over the fighter when she just called them all MTV skanks. You know, that was my favorite moment.
What is I'm trying to decide what films I'm going to be seeing.
Oh, okay, that's right.
I can't tell whether I'm going to get a chuckle from this movie or whether it's going to be sort
depressing.
Of like Goodfellas. No. You know, like a Or it doesn't easily fit into a category?
No, you'll definitely laugh. And in fact, it picked up a ton of Golden Globe nominations, and they're all in the best comedy or musical category. It's extremely funny, and it's great to watch Bradley Cooper and even Christian Bale, who, by the way, the film begins, I can say this, it's not giving anything away, because it begins on his big pot belly, his big bare belly, and moves up to him in his comb over. So even he's having fun with this part, but of course in the intense Christian Bale way.
All right, the next movie that I think we have to talk about, because there will be a lot of settling, you know, which movie are we all going to go see that we can all go together at the same time. Let's hear a little clip from the hardly at all promoted Anchorman 2. We don't have a clip for that. We do have a clip? Oh, we don't. Well, then I'll make it up. We don't have a clip for Anchorman 2. Anchorman 2, no, yes.
No, I liked it.
You liked it.
I have to say I was a little bit afraid because, the marketing was so intense for this movie, even when Will Ferrell came here recently to Boston where they renamed the Emerson, my alma mater, the Emerson College School of Communication Ron Burgundy. I didn't know that, your fellow Emerson alum. So
it was a good school back then, you know.
And he was so good in the marketing. And when I saw him live doing this press conference where he had to stay as Ron Burgundy for 45 minutes unscripted, I thought, how could the film actually measure up, first of all, to the first one, let alone what he's been doing, you know, hilariously with the anchor in North Dakota and all the other things? This movie is really, really funny. I mean, it's very sophomoric. It's very juvenile. I loved it. I laughed a lot. And basically, this sets him a little bit in the future. He's now married. He has a child. He's lost his job. He's a drunk at SeaWorld, which is just ridiculous. And he's hired to be one of the lead anchors on a new, because this is the 70s again, 24-hour cable news network. And of course, it anticipates everything that we hate about news media today, from the on-screen graphics to the political ideology.
Now, is this a movie that we should go see now? Should we wait for it to come out on cable, or should we get the DVD?
I don't know that there's any other film right now where you can just go in guilt-free and just have belly laughs.
Mm-hmm.
American Hustle is a little bit more intellectual. So I would say see it now just for laughs. But, of course, it's one you can wait for.
Okay,
as well.
For heartwarming, Philomena, would that fall under a heartwarming kind of?
It's definitely heartwarming.
Yeah.
We have Judi Dench, who's fantastic, now a Golden Globe nominee. She's this Irish woman who decides after 50 years she wants to trace the son that she was forced to give up for adoption. This is based on a true story where she collaborated with a former BBC journalist, Martin Sixsmith, and it takes them to America. And I mean, you can just watch Judi Dench do just about anything, I think. And here she's just remarkable. And the pair, Steve... I've just forgotten his name.
Stephen Frears.
He's the director,
yep.
And her Steve Coogan, I believe, who plays the journalist. Watching the two of them together as they go on this journey, and knowing that it was based on a true story, because we've heard this story so many times now about these terrible situation, these Irish women put in these convents and forced into employment, basically. But it's a great journey that you see.
And of course, I'm Not Bob Dylan. The Inside Llewellyn Davis, the Coen brothers movie.
Inside Llewellyn Davis. Everybody
Llewellyn,
gets confused.
So
Everybody
hard.
Says that. This is the new Coen brothers movie, and it's an odyssey. It's a week in the life of Llewellyn Davis, played by Oscar Isaac, who also just received a Best Actor nomination. And it's set in 1961, the Greenwich Village folk scene. And it's the Coen brothers, so it's a little bit off-kilter, a little bit demented. You have all these muted colors. And one of the characters, Carey Mulligan's character, has this great description of who Oscar Isaac is. He's basically King Midas's dysfunctional brother, because everything he touches turns to... And I can't finish the sentence because it's an expletive.
Yeah.
So it's easy. You know,
but this is a great... The New York folk scene is a great unrecognized cultural moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we'll
which is why I'm looking forward to that.
Now, two things you wanted to talk about. If you don't want to go to the movies, what else can you do?
You can also see Robin Hood, The Heart of Robin Hood, which is at the American Repertory Theater right now. It just opened, and this is fantastic. It's good for families, not young kids, because there is a little bit of violence. But this is really an inventive, ingenious production where they use the staging so inventively. They have a big slide that's basically it's supposed to represent a mountain, so all the characters slide into the stage. You have characters descending from the ceiling upside down. And it basically tells the story of Robin Hood through the point of view of Marion.
Okay, great. Well, we'll make sure we see that. We didn't get to mention The Secret Life of Walter Mitty and Mr. Banks. Yes. Thumbs up for both
thumbs
of them.
Up. Also, the other piece of theater you have to see, Henry VIII, Actor Shakespeare Project. Delicious, perfect acting.
Great. Jared's keeping us busy over this holiday, so make sure you get out of the house, especially if you don't want to be there. Jared Bowen is the... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm totally confused here. I'm rushing you out. So I'm going to welcome you back.
So I was looking at the clock. I was like, I have 10
yes,
more minutes.
Yes, I'm sorry.
And I have so much to tell you. And
tell me
was
some
it
more.
Something I said?
Yes,
too?
You know what? It was because you thought I was much younger than I am. And it's totally an insult to the
flustered.
Elderly.
No,
you know?
You're flustered now. It was a compliment.
Let's back you up and talk about Mr. Banks, which I'm totally, completely fascinated about because of the sort of pro and anti-Disney camps. You know, I think that, and I don't mean just like the Big D Disney. I mean the folks that think that Walt Disney was an evil genius and those who think he was a beneficial, wonderful genius. I kind of fall on the he's a good guy. And this, talk a little bit about the scene of this movie, the setup of this movie with the author of Mary Poppins.
So I knew a little bit about this before because I had interviewed Richard Sherman several years ago, and he's the one who, along with his brother Robert, wrote all of the music to Mary Poppins and a number of other Disney songs, including Walt Disney's favorite, Feed the Birds, which, of course, is in Mary Poppins. And he had told me what a difficult person P.L. Travers was and that they had a really horrendous time when she came from England, where she had been living, to Los Angeles to oversee sort of the launch of the film making in terms of the making of the music and the screenplay. And as is depicted in the film, and all of this is based on actual, they have recordings of these sessions with her where she's this hard woman. She hates the color red. She doesn't want she doesn't want any music in it. She doesn't want any animation. She doesn't want Dick Van Dyke in the film. I mean, she's just a very difficult person. And what this film does, and it is produced by Disney, and I think in a really good way because it actually presents Walt Disney as Tom Hanks smoking a cigarette. So they're not trying to put the shine on Disney necessarily here. But what they do is they layer it so that you understand more about P.L. Travers' childhood growing up in Australia, the relationship she had with her father, which is very difficult, very harrowing, and you understand why she creates this character of Mary Poppins who comes into these children's lives and the influence that she's supposed to have. I think it's beautifully layered. I love the way it's told, and Emma Thompson will just break your heart as P.L. Travers.
What from watching the trailers of this, it's almost as if Tom Hanks is playing a somewhat sinister Disney.
You know,
no.
Well, I mean, there's an edge
it's
to
watch
him.
It, watching yeah. him in the previews makes me want to go see that movie.
Well, see, I have such a problem with trailers and previews because in many cases, especially in the last couple of weeks, and this is the case here with Saving Mr. Banks, it's the case with August, Osage County, the trailers do not represent what these films actually are. Because I saw the trailer for Saving Mr. Banks and I thought, they're Disneyfying it. This is not the story that was told to me by Richard Sherman. They make it look like she's the lovable curmudgeon and Walt Disney's out to save the world. That's not at all
see,
what
I
this film is.
See, I didn't get that from the trailer. That's interesting because I got sort of to Peter's point that it isn't going to be one of those Disney whitewash moments, you know, that it actually
really?
Does have a little grit to it. And, you know, I mean, maybe we're more sophisticated than the, you know, the folks that
well,
don't go to movies a lot where it's...
The old New Yorker writer and Esquire film critic, Dwight McDonald, tried to get the New York Times to publish a letter of his saying that she was a fascist. Mary Poppins
right,
is a fascist.
Right. So it's interesting.
Very
I mean,
down on
it's interesting, but I'm glad to hear that's good. And I was rushing you through Walter Mitty, The Secret Life. You know, ooh, you're making a face? No, man.
Yeah, I didn't love it. Of course, it's the remake. It's about Walter Mitty is I overuse the word hapless. Maybe at this time of year, everybody's a hapless person because they want people for audiences to identify with. But he's this sort of schlub who is the negatives guy at Life magazine, right. And it's about to be taken over, and he really can't deal with life, so he escapes to these flights of fancy, which of course we see these outlandish things as he sort of goes off in his own little world until he sort of comes into his own and realize it's a self-actualization. He realizes his potential by going on these travels, and it's directed by Ben Stiller. It stars Ben Stiller, mm-hmm. also falling in love with Kristen Wiig in this film, and I don't know, it just sort of plods along. I like the message at the end in that you can be who you want to be if you put some effort into it, but it felt a little too self-indulgent.
You know, the other part of it too was I don't really know sometimes how to take Ben Stiller, and I don't mean that as critical as it sounds. Like I can tell when I see a trailer with Tom Hanks in it, which Tom Hanks I'm going to get. Yeah. You know, like, is it going to be the Tom Hanks acting, or is it going to be Tom Hanks being Tom Hanks? And with Ben Stiller, it's like I don't know. At first, when I first saw the trailer, I didn't know if this was going to be another slapstick crazy Ben Stiller, or is this the serious Ben Stiller, which I don't know that we've really ever seen yet.
Yeah, it's an amalgamation, and I do feel like he is trying to move towards something. I feel like everybody in his peer group is right now, right? Matthew McConaughey with Dallas Buyers Club. We see these actors who were sort of pigeonholed in certain, mm-hmm. like Tom Hanks was years ago with Bosom Buddies and Big before he became this different kind of actor.
Right,
and I think maybe that's something Ben Stiller is moving toward.
Now, I rushed you through the second theater piece, so...
Henry VIII.
Yeah, Henry VIII, which needs more than just a second, I can imagine.
Henry VIII, of course, we know that he's the marrying, murdering king. Had a penchant for marrying, going through wives and dispatching them
and
in certain ways.
And turkey legs. Don't forget the turkey legs.
Turkey legs. This is Shakespeare. It's believed to be Shakespeare's last play, if you also believe that he actually wrote it. Some people question that. This is directed by Tina Packer, who is a preeminent Shakespeare scholar. She's one of the people who founded Shakespeare and Company out in the Berkshires. This is really a lush production. It's not the greatest play as written by Shakespeare. It's a history play, and it's really sort of idolizes Queen Elizabeth and how she came to be. And the end is just this fawning soliloquy about Elizabeth. But in the hands of Actors Shakespeare Project, this is brilliant. First of all, fantastic costumes, excellent staging, and phenomenal acting. And if you like Shakespeare, if you love history, there's every reason to see this piece because this is one terrific ensemble. I saw it on Saturday and was just bowled over by how good this production is. And it's staged very intimately in the modern theater. So you have the actors coming in and around, and it almost evokes that Globe Theater experience. Of course, Globe Theater is where all of Shakespeare's play, a lot of them happened, mm-hmm. including this one when they fired a cannon and the Globe Theater burned down. It was during Henry VIII. I asked them, they have their fire extinguishers, so history is not going to be repeated.
That's good news. So will you see a movie? Is there a movie you haven't seen yet? Will there be one in your future?
Will
there be one you'll see again?
The only one that I missed was The Wolf of Wall Street. I am dying to see it.
Are you really?
So I will be going to the theater over the holiday to see that.
Okay, well, look for your review when you come back. Thanks so much, and I appreciate you not running out when I pushed you out. Holding his ground, Jared Bowen. We appreciate it. He's GBH's arts reporter and host of the TV show Open Studio. Have a great holiday. We'll see you at the theater. When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Reverend Irene Monroe. She goes to war with the war on Christmas, among other things. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Joe Bergantino, executive director of the New England Center for Investigative Reporting.
Because we have the time to do stories that other news outlets can't do, the New England Center for Investigative Reporting is doing stories that no one else will have even the inclination in some cases to do. So we're a unique piece of American journalism based here at WGBH.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, now in partnership with WGBH News.
Funding for our programs comes from you. And SNH Construction, a general contracting firm serving the greater Boston area, specializing in residential renovations, custom building, historic restorations, renewable energy, and site work solutions. shconstruction.com. And Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru Forester with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Joining us in Studio 3 for Open Mic is the fabulous Irene Monroe. She's a syndicated columnist. You could read her in Bay Windows every week. The Huffington Post. Reverend Irene, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's wonderful to have a sighting of my editor.
I know. Wow. Irene and I probably communicate more. I think I communicate with you more than anyone else in my life. But we never really get to see each other. So this is a treat, Peter.
Yeah, I had
isn't
to
it?
Come down to the studio to have a sighting.
It's all email, text.
It is.
Every Wednesday.
Every Wednesday, every if Wednesday. Not more. So, you
is
know,
she any good as an editor?
No.
You know, I'm the only one there, so that's what has to happen. I'm the best editor there.
She really is. She cleans my texts up very nicely. I'm forever thankful.
You're welcome. I'm happy to do it. But, you know, one of the things that broke in the news this last week, we've been, you know, bashing Barack Obama a little bit earlier in the show about what a bad year it's had. And then every now and then the administration has this stroke of genius. And as some of our listeners may or may not know, Russia has this, it's beyond the pale, the really restrictive and punitive laws against gay and lesbian expression, much less behavior, that if you are openly gay in any way, you can, in fact, be put in jail. And that has been seeping down through the regular folk in Russia who are some of the bad elements are really taking it upon themselves to personally beat people who they see as gay. Of course, Sochi, the Olympics are coming up just as the year turns, and that has put many Western countries in a bind. How do we deal with this issue of such a restrictive, terrible place for civil rights for gays and lesbians? President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama have said they will not go to Sochi.
Good.
Vice President Joe Biden and Mrs. Dr. Biden say they will not go to Sochi. So instead of going to Sochi, they are sending openly gay athletes like Billie Jean King is leading the delegation.
I think it's a fabulous coup, really. Just to say that, you know, that we don't tolerate anti-gay bigotry. It sort of reminds me of the Berlin Olympics, if you remember. You know, they sort of had a lot of propaganda about, you know, anti-black and Jewish, you know, sentiments. And what better way than to send the very people that you discriminate against?
You know, and you know, Peter, Billie Jean King, of course, more than just a lesbian icon. For any woman, young woman who is playing sports today in an organized fashion.
Yeah.
She really changed the course of girls and women's sports participation with her works on
Title 9.
We got it.
That
eggnog is so good.
Okay.
Her famous tennis match with Bobby Riggs, which it's funny. I remember that night. That was the same summer that Nixon resigned.
Yep, that was in the early 1970s where Bobby Riggs, a male
chauvinist pig.
Yep, I was,
okay.
And it was challenged to play Billie Jean King.
There was those the night Nixon resigned and the night of the Billy the Riggs King match. No one was on the streets of Boston.
Yeah.
They were totally empty. What I'm saying is, her tennis match had the same effect on the public in Boston as Nixon's resignation did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, it was huge.
Mm-hmm. My concern about the Olympics really is about the our LGBTQ athletes. In no way should they be closeted about who they are. But I am concerned about their safety. I think it is wonderful that Obama will not be present and a number of people. But what do we do with a culture? See, it's one thing because we know, you know, we know Putin is not going to do anything. He's trying to clean up his act as much as possible.
Releasing pussy riots.
Pussy riots and stuff like that. But the culture is what I'm concerned about. And they have perceptions of what people might, you know, their thoughts of who might be gay. So that's the thing that I'm concerned about, an athlete who leaves the pavilion, someone that, you know, who they think is not performing their gender identity correctly, raises some serious issues here.
Now, how do you feel about the issue of boycott? A lot of folks responded in the LGBT community about the sending openly gay athletes.
See, it's a mixed bag. You know, listen, as an athlete, you've trained for 4 years. You do not want this opportunity to become a political issue. And you have every right, actually, to be there. But it does, when you boycott these Olympics, it's making a profound political statement. But then what do you do? Well, the spillout or the spillover is those LGBT athletes who won't get a chance to participate. Yeah. And I think particularly since there is this perception that, you know, you can't be athletic and LGBTQ, more reason in my sense to go there and whip ass. Can I say that on
well, you just there? Did, so there you go. And you're a reverend, so you can say whatever you want with a pass. You know, also in the news this week, and again, you know, sometimes I get crazy with the media, it got overshadowed by a relative connection, but President Obama commuted sentences for 8 people who were in jail for a ridiculous amount of time for crack cocaine arrests. One of them happened to be a cousin to our Governor Deval Patrick, and Governor Patrick says that he had no knowledge of it and has, to his recollection, not met the man. But, you know, it's hard for some people, I think, to understand that not long ago, the laws around crack cocaine were much stricter and much more punitive than the laws around having powder cocaine.
Right. I mean, unfortunately, and I applaud Obama for this act, really, because the issue is that we really begin to see the fault line around race and class when it comes to certain types of, you know, what we perceive to be criminal action, and particularly around crack cocaine here and stuff. So absolutely. And these guys have served already 15 years and they're not violent criminals. And the interesting thing that bothers me about the industrial prison complex, we will spend much more money to put a black and brown man in prison than to send him to school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have to begin to say, now what's up with that picture?
Well, it's shocking when you consider the depth of the imprisoned population. We have the United States leads the world more than repressive China or more than repressive Russia. We have 25%. The United States alone has 25% of all the incarcerated people in the world, and going along with it, there are terrible health situations, that tuberculosis among those imprisoned is 50% to 100% higher than it is among the general population. And if you took the millions of people we have incarcerated and treated them as if they were a separate nation, it would be would have the worst TB problem on the planet.
That's right.
You know,
it's
interesting about the analysis between the powder cocaine and the crack cocaine, because the other part of this, which you speak to, is that you could possess this crack cocaine, which by science is less powerful than powder cocaine.
That's
it lasts more quickly. It wears off more quickly. And just about the time that America was starting to realize that folks who had crack cocaine possession were getting much more heavier sentences than those who had powder cocaine, Tim Allen, who is Santa Claus these days. Tim Allen, when
he was a
stand-up comedian, was arrested in college with cocaine powder that he was going to distribute. And I don't know if he served a little jail time or he got a little parole, but he was able to go on and start his life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was able to go off to California and become Tim Allen, who
right.
we
Absolutely.
All love and spend all of our holidays with watching the Santa Claus movies over and over again. Had he been an African-American young man in college with a little bit of crack cocaine, he'd still be in jail.
So it brings the question to the fore. The real issue is about race, and it permeates in various ways. Crack cocaine is just one of those ways in which we can look at it, and certainly the industrial prison complex is another. And they too, unfortunately, work hand in hand together.
Now, speaking of Tim Allen, and speaking of Santa Claus,
Oh,
you know,
my.
We got to go right to the Santa Claus. you know, this was one of those moments in, I don't know what happened at the end of this year where all the crazies, you know, the usual war on Christmas I've sort of come to expect.
It's been happening, though, since I think really we can date it back to 2005.
We were talking about that upstairs in the WGBH newsroom.
Yeah.
When did people start really thinking there was a war on Christmas? Was it when a store employee started saying happy holidays, which one would think if you were a conservative, you'd be happy because it would generate more business? You know, if you're not offended when you're buying the tie, you should be happy to hear happy holidays.
You know, I call these people Christmas apologists. Basically, what they want is just their image of Christmas or of this time of year to just be seen and nothing else.
But and this strikes me that it's so illogical that their image of Christmas isn't even the Christmas that would be in the Bible or the Christmas that most...
Well, according to Megan... Well, you see, now it depends because according to Megan Kelly, Santa is white.
He is?
Mm-hmm. And Jesus, too. So, you know?
Now, how we've talked about this in Irene's column in this week's Bay Windows, the Rights War on Christmas Continues, as we were working back and forth on this via text message.
That's right. Tweaking it.
You know, it's amazing to me that the historical Jesus is totally left out of this discussion. And how can you be an intelligent Christian? How can you be a college-educated Christian and think that those pictures that you've seen of Jesus all these years that were painted by nice Italian men, you know?
Well, you know, my thing is this. I refuse, because it really starts with Fox News. I really refuse to believe that all these people there are ignorant. And I also refuse to believe that they don't fact check. So a lot of what they're doing to me, that's why I call them Christmas apologists. They basically want their image of this holiday to permeate, to be the dominant image.
I have to say that just however many years this has been going on, I don't think anyone pays any attention to it. I mean, I think we in the media are in the way. I'm not saying we're creating the problem, but I just don't. I know people of all political stripes. And, you know, sooner or later you hear someone say, well, I hate to say, but this person's right. I just don't. I have yet to meet anyone paid any attention.
But see, we reside in a bubble. We really do.
Yeah. I'm talking about blue-collar people. I'm going out of my way to find to get people to engage in it.
But I think the audacity is worth reporting on. I mean, I agree with both of you that there are people who hang on this and go, Santa Claus is white, I told you. But there's also just the audacity. If we don't call them on these crazy statements.
Like Phil Robertson.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, you know, I mean, we had Duck Dynasty, which also kind of folds into this, where you've got the Sarah Palins of the world who, you know, just can...
Well, was
don't
anyone
understand.
Surprised that Robinson said that? I mean,
I was, because, you know, I need to say that you can't judge a book by its cover.
And now we're talking about Duck Dynasty,
you know,
of course.
Phil Robinson is an educated man. Okay, this is a gentleman that not only has a bachelor's, but he has a master's in education. So, again, there's a certain level here. I didn't think it was a disconnect. It's about dominating and having a particular view that he just wants to see, because it's not like he doesn't know better. We like to think, okay, these are country bumpkins. But, you know, his clan is very well-educated.
Oh, yeah.
Let our listeners know what they said in case we're not following the Duck Dynasty. He made comments about homosexuality and, again, went back to the old Senator Rick Santorum, bestiality. Not only is it a sin, but it's also as bad as bestiality. He talked about knowing African-Americans and never...
In Jim Crow America when he was growing up.
When he was growing
was
up.
Was it mistreated? And to reinscribe
and
this
never really
icon
saw
of the happy black person.
Right. Never saw anybody. They all looked happy to me, and I didn't see any discrimination.
And I wasn't, by the way, said that, I wasn't surprised at the single thing he said. I mean,
but
maybe
why,
it should
though?
Be
Is
a shame.
Because of the way he looked? See, or because of where he resides? Because, see, I don't make that assumption, because there are some progressive people in all of those areas.
There are, but the whole shtick they were putting forward.
Yeah, but this isn't a is a part of it. Like, I'm from my TV hat, it would be great if he had said that on their reality, in quotes, television show, where we're only seeing the happy, you know, the scrubbed version what people think, for all the reality shows, not just for them. But I had more of my reaction to it was more from the critics. You know, how dare the same people who said the Dixie Chicks could not criticize President Bush. You know, remember the Dixie
Chicks?
That's
right.
Like,
yeah,
you know, eight
I
years
remember.
Ago,
yeah.
Criticized Bush, fell off the country charts. But we're not allowed to criticize someone who is saying something that's not even
logical.
Within the American
that's
logic,
right,
you know?
Right.
And
his revisionist history at best, if not just
well,
fantasy.
Well, what he was saying was so sweepingly vile.
Yep, yep.
To me, I mean, it was.
See, but he falls under this heading, this rubric of freedom of speech.
Right.
Okay. And
well,
and the freedom right. to espouse his religious views, which I don't knock that at all. But I'm glad that A&E stepped up and said, you can go. It works both ways
yeah.
here.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, back to the Santa is white business. You know, this disturbs me on so many levels. And I wanted I just
I never had a white Santa.
You always well, you know,
my Santa, you know, was the black man in the house, you know.
My daughter and I are reading she's been kind of homebound for a while. So we've been reading stories about Christmas around the world. She's 13. And suddenly, you know, she really believes in Santa Claus December 1st of every year, because if you don't believe, you don't receive. And we're talking about how the Santa Claus person, the Santa Claus spirit of Christmas goes around the world. And it's different in every country.
But you know what, though? It is, though. But I think, and listen, I'm not certainly siding with Megyn Kelly and them, but they are talking about the commercial image.
Right.
But also, I'm going to give you an example of a place that I didn't expect to see a white Santa and its helpers being who their helpers are. My partner and I, we went to Amsterdam this summer. And what we found, and we went to Amsterdam, one of the reasons in terms of European countries is simply because, listen, this is a place you can be gay. Listen, they allow legal prostitution, you name it. It espouses a kind of progressivism that invites the world. We find out about Black Pete. So if I was in Amsterdam today, I would see a lot of white folks in blackface. And Amsterdam pushes back vehemently about criticizing that image, saying, listen, that black slave helper is, you know.
Oh, he's a revisionist. He's not a slave helper anymore, isn't he? Isn't he a
one of the elves?
Sailor? No, I think he was a sailor from Morocco or, oh, you know, right. This whole Black Pete thing, this is like worthy of another show. I mean, but, you know, at the same time, the history of blackface for them is not the same as the history of blackface for us.
And they think it negates the fact that since it's a different history, it then escapes the whole notion of being racist.
Right.
But the real issue is that if I were at, you know, I wouldn't be having a Merry Christmas if I were in Holland.
I'm not laughing at your pain.
No.
I'm just laughing because I would have loved to seen your face in there.
And then to see a bunch, to see a culture of white folks unabashedly.
Really white.
Really, really. Put black on their face, black tar on their face, and think it's an example of
diversity.
Well, that too. But reverence.
Reverence. Well, Irene, we could go on and on, but we're running out of time.
I'm so sorry.
But it's good that we get to see you.
We get to see each other.
This
gonna
is
have to
exciting.
Do this more.
We are. And you can check out Irene Monroe at Huffington Post and at
my
Bay Windows.
Pleasure meeting you.
Merry Christmas to you. Happy holidays and all that. And Santa is whomever you want him
That's
to
right.
be.
That's right. Absolutely.
There you go.
Ho,
or her.
Ho, ho.
Or her to be. Reverend Irene Monroe, thanks so much. When we come back, film critic Garen Daly joins us to talk about all the things you don't know about It's a Wonderful Life, the ultimate behind-the-scenes look at that Christmas classic is next.
A very sinister movie.
Congress got the fiscal holiday humbug.
The idea that we're going to cut off benefits for people who are long-term unemployed, people who are working to try to get back into the job market, and just say, you're out of luck. I just don't think we can do that.
Senator Elizabeth Warren next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Museum of Science, where you can bring your intellectual appetite to our global kitchen. You'll learn that the food you eat connects you to people and places you've never known. Now on exhibit. More at mos.org/globalkitchen. And Skinner, auctioneers and appraisers of antiques and fine art. You might consider auction when downsizing a home or selling a collection. 60 auctions annually, 20 collecting categories, Boston and Marlboro. Online at SkinnerInc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Sue O'Connell here with Peter Kadzis. We're in for Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Well, we're here for the great holiday throwdown. This is the kind of great debate we have here on public radio. Is It's a Wonderful Life the best Christmas movie ever made? And though many of us have seen it a million times, film critic Garen Daly is here to tell us about the things we don't know about the Christmas classic. Welcome back, Garen.
Hi, guys.
And Peter Kadzis, my co-host, not a fan of It's a
Wonderful
Life.
No, I'm not here to debate. I don't want to ruin everyone's Christmas.
No, I want you to.
No. I understand that people are delusional about this movie, and I think that's terrific. I mean, George Bailey, to me, the only character who bugs me more is Bates on Downton Abbey. I mean, they should have hung Bates when they had the chance. But let's
Peter, go. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you like Vertigo?
I love Vertigo.
So what you see in It's a Wonderful Life is the emergence of Jimmy Stewart as a character who can play Vertigo, because that's what George Bailey is. He's two characters in one.
Well, I gotta say, you stopped me in my tracks there. I love Harvey.
Well, that's the other side. That's the sweetness of Jimmy Stewart.
I'm surprised. I don't usually like sweet Jimmy Stewart, but I'm surprised that I really like Harvey. And I'll just confess that my favorite Christmas movie is Miracle on 34th Street.
Right.
It is just that. It's a Wonderful Life has always annoyed the living daylights
out of
me.
Many of our listeners know it was not a big box office hit.
But it wasn't as bad as what people said. There are a lot of myths about this film, and hopefully we'll dispel a few of them.
But, the thing I love about It's a Wonderful Life is it's really twisted.
It
is a dark, twisted, dark, dark place for Christmas. And that's the part that I love about it.
Think about this a second. If you take out the beginning and the end and consider them framing devices, the film tips when George jumps into the river to save Clarence, who is his guardian angel.
I like Clarence.
We all love Clarence. But that's where the film tips. And here's a clip in the toll house after they've just been rescued.
How did you happen to fall in?
I didn't fall in. I jumped in to save George.
What? To save me?
Well, I did, didn't I? You didn't go through with it, did you?
Go through with what?
Suicide.
Oh, it's against the law to commit suicide around here.
Yeah, it's against the law where I come from, too.
Where do you come from? Heaven?
Again, it's a wonderful scene.
He should have done it then.
Well, I love that it's just a whole movie about enabling. Like, everybody's enabling everybody.
Yeah, it is all that. I mean, but, what I love, this, when I look at a film like this, I start looking at the little things. For instance, the film that, we're talking about Clarence. Clarence was Mr. Bogardus in Bells of St. Mary's. Bells of St. Mary's is playing on the marquee in the pure Bedford Falls. But again, the thing is that it becomes a film that is very, very dark, and it really becomes a precursor for noir films. When you look at Pottersville, and think about it, Pottersville, Potter's Field. I mean, there's a reason why he chose those names, because again, Potter's Field is where all the strangers are buried, and there's a lot of references to burial inside of It's a Wonderful Life.
The scene that I grew up watching it over and over and over again. It used to be, before it became sort of this touchstone moment, I think when NBC buy it, was that, or one of the networks bought it?
Someone finally ended up getting the rights.
But you'd see it over. I had chicken pox one year when I was like 23, and I was home for the holidays. I must have seen it 3,422 times, But when you finally kind of sit and look at it after you haven't seen it for a while, the scene when young George saves the pharmacist from making fatal mistake mixing some medicine after he's got news that his son has been killed. I mean, I still get goosebumps from that scene.
Well, there's great pieces of trivia in this. First of all, Mr. Gower is played by H.B. Warner, who in 1927 or 1925 played Christ in King of Kings. And this was the first time he got to play a role that was slightly different. The other thing that I noticed about it is Mr. Gower's son dies in the 1919 flu epidemic, mm-hmm. which devastated the United States, which is another nice little bit. And the third thing is, it's the precursor of alcohol within the movie. When he runs into difficulty, he gets drunk. When he's undergoing a dramatic amount of stress, he gets drunk. George gets drunk as well. So there's a thing going on about alcohol that is underlying everything else when things get tough for these people.
What are some of the other points? We talked, touched on just for a moment, the box office myth of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's more just in comparison to how big a movie it has become. But when it opened, what was the time like for the environment for movies? And
well, first of all, wow, that's a loaded question. The framing of the timing for films at this point, this is right after World War II. It's post-war. It's Frank Capra's first film after World War II. We spent 4 years. It's first film after Jimmy Stewart became a bomber group commander in World War II. And Jimmy Stewart was very nervous about this. The film was produced by Liberty Films, which is a group of directors, Frank Capra, William Wyler, who made Best Years of Our Lives the same year, and George Stevens, who was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. And they created it as a beginning of the – it really kind of breaks the old Hollywood studio system and the new emerging producer-director thing. They're the first ones to really do it after World War II. Ultimately, Liberty Films failed. So that was kind of what was being set up on the business side of things. In terms of the film coming out, plenty of publicity. It cost more than they anticipated. It cost about $3.1 million to make. Overall, it ended up grossing $3 million, which is not enough when you take out what the exhibitors would kick back. So it only really grossed in true net figures about $1.5 million. So, you know, it was a failure in some ways. But one of the reasons it failed also was because, they couldn't get global positioning well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing that's my business partner, Jeff Coakley, and I are huge fans of the movie. And whenever one of us forgets to make the deposit for the business, we get a text, Uncle Billy, what bar are you at? You know, the character of Uncle Billy and his driving through the film is a fascinating one to me. That he sort of represents both George's childhood and his adulthood and the world that George is stuck in, and very much he believes he's stuck in.
Right.
Because he is. The brother gets all the bonuses and he gets the travel, the world travel.
Yeah, not to dispute the greatness or lack thereof of the movie, because so many people love it. I won't dispute that. But when did the film really begin to pick up this head of steam? You know, when was it on the road to becoming a cult classic?
I would say 60s and the 70s, after it was all, like, Sue was just saying, it's all over TV and we get to see it and we get to see all these things. And it starts hitting some sort of resonant theme within us about that we're no longer a failure if we have friends. But I think underneath it is we kind of see the darkness there. But going back to Uncle Billy, who's played by Thomas Mitchell, there is a wonderful scene that everyone knows when they're at the party for Harry. He's just come back from the war as a war hero, and he's leaving the place. And I want to listen to the scene, and I want to explain something about it.
Boy, now look, if you point me in the right direction, would you do that, George? Old Bill in the lone pal, huh?
Now you just turn this way, on that right straight down there.
Well, that way, huh? My wild Irish road.
So the setup is that was actually a stagehand knocking over all these lights, and Bill Thomas Mitchell just ran with it and added that, ad-libbed all that stuff in. So it was a mistake. They saw how funny it was. They added it in. And that's one of the geniuses of Frank Capra. When these things happen, he just incorporated. I mean, we don't even – here's some great bits of trivia. This was originally written by a guy by the name of Philip Van Doren Stern, who couldn't sell it, like 30 applications or rejections from publishers. He finally sent it out as a Christmas card to about 200 friends, ended up in the hands of a producer in Hollywood who gave it to Cary Grant, who wanted to play in it and sold it to RKO. RKO had three writers work on it. Clifford Odets, good writer. Dalton Trumbull, good writer. Mark Connelly, good writer. And they could not do anything with it. It was only when Frank Capra took it over that he was able to do something with it.
We're talking with Garen Daly about It's a Wonderful Life, a bit of the secret life of life. What else is in it that we're missing when we watch it?
Well, this is one of my favorite scenes. And I do a lot of reading on this. And I read the Janine Bassinger book on it. No one talks about this scene. So this is like, I feel like it's mine. But do you remember the scene when Bert the cop in the noir thing shoots at Mr. George Bailey? And I don't know if you noticed it, but when he shoots the shot, he actually hits a sign in the background, and it says Pottersville, and he shoots out the V, so it says Potter's Ill. These kind of little visual cues. I mean, for instance, do you know why? I mean, I can't even find an answer for this other than a supposition, but the name of the God figure, there's Joseph, mm-hmm. but the name of the God figure is Franklin. And I'm assuming that it's because it's Franklin Roosevelt, yeah. and Frank Capra did not like Franklin Roosevelt and thought that he played God. So there are a lot of little things.
Criticism of the current administration.
Yeah. At that particular point in time, yeah.
You know, the other part of it, which the film, which is, when you go back and watch films, like every year I love that the kids watch the things that I watched growing up, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the claymation things. And happily, they're all shocked at what a terrible world women lived in. You know, that the mother reindeer's not allowed to go out. It's a man's job to go find Rudolph. But in It's a Wonderful Life, women aren't in the same stereotypical roles that they are in other movies of that time. I mean, I think that there's a power there that is palpable. I mean, they're not in the main characters by any means.
Yes, yes, and no. Because let's think about it. I mean, when you think about Donna Reed as the spinster, I mean, she doesn't marry Jimmy Stewart, and so she ends up becoming this dour little librarian with the glasses. Yeah. And they had to put so much makeup on her to make her look old because she was a gorgeous 25-year-old at the time. And even in, you know, the classic scene of the kiss where, you know, they finally are coming together. There's
when
so much so much in that scene. Here's a clip of that.
Money, yeah. Well, a little.
Well, now listen. I want you to put every cent you've got into our stock. Do you hear? And, George, I may have a job for you. That is, unless you're still married to that broken-down building and loan. Mary.
I'm here.
Will you tell that guy I'm giving him the chance of a lifetime, do you hear? The chance of a lifetime.
He says it's the chance of a lifetime.
Now, you listen to me. I don't want any plastics. I don't want any ground floors. And I don't want to get married ever to anyone. You understand that? I want to do what I want to do. And you're...
George.
Now, you have to understand that the censors censored this because the kiss was too long and too hot. But it says so much about what's going on with the film. First of all, you have this woman who is like just the only person she's ever going to marry is going to be George Bailey. It's fated that way. On the other side, you've got George Bailey relinquishing his dreams that he's going to do all these great things and discover the world because of a love of a woman. So there's so much in that one particular scene between those two guys. Now, the other part, the great trivia about this is that in production, they were absolutely terrified, or Jimmy Stewart was terrified about doing the kiss. He had not been doing anything like this for 4 years. He was happily married. He knew he had to act. He was afraid of acting in a romantic thing. So he kept putting it off and putting it off. And they literally rewrote the script so that they were going to be on the phone together and he would not be able to back out of it. So, I mean, there's just some of the little thingies that are going on in the film.
You know, the part I think that resonates as well with anybody who becomes middle-aged is what George Bailey put aside. you know, that from the get-go he has, as a child, an accident saving his brother.
Right.
And his brother sort of plays the heir apparent, or the lucky one, if you will, in the film, where he saves his brother from this sledding accident, and George goes deaf in one ear, so he can't go to war, which sounds like a good thing, but, you know, he doesn't get to travel the world. He always seems to be putting someone else's needs ahead of his. And that sort of, I think, adds to his kind of roiling, jumping off the bridge business, you know?
Well, yes, he's incredibly frustrated. And, you know, one question you have to ask is, well, what would happen if he did go away? Would he have built better things? Would he have helped more people?
See, maybe that's what bugs me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't see any evidence in the way he conducts himself that he would have done any better anywhere else.
But none of us know. But I think that's the beautiful point of it, because when you're having a bad day and you're thinking, oh my gosh, look at what I've sacrificed to get here. You know, I always call it the David Cassidy issue. Like, David Cassidy, the TV singer, thinks that if he wasn't on the Partridge Family, he'd be a big rock star. Maybe not. You know, but that's the kind of human condition that we all live with, that we like to think we'd be better off if we could have done something else on a dark day. But the reality is...
Well, and think about the film in general. If the film had not lost its rights and was able to play on TV for free for years, would it have found the audience
right.
and become this iconic film?
No, probably not.
Yep.
Well, I don't know. I'm not so sure. I think it spoke to I can understand why it wasn't a big success when it came out. I mean, just because it was an odd combination of factors that America might not have been commercially ready to accept. I mean, it is a quirky film. And so to me, and I don't expect other people to agree, it's saccharine, but in a very interesting way. And when it caught America's imagination, I remember a talk of the town piece in the New Yorker, where Frank Capra would come and they have a little viewing party. It was a pretty cynical time, and it was It's a Wonderful Night, Life was sort of an anecdote to that.
But I think what we're doing is when we're talking like this, we're seeing only that beginning and end, where there's this small town mm-hmm. paradise that we kind of pine for versus this very dark, noirish thing. I mean, think about it. Pottersville was much more interesting than Bedford Falls.
They had gambling
and dancing. Yeah. Yeah, all sorts of good things.
Neon.
Yeah?
You know, someone up.
Imagine Orson Welles playing Old Man Potter.
Oh, I love Old Man Potter.
Oh, well, the casting in this film is pretty.
No, it is. Yeah. But all of a sudden, I'm seeing the upside of a really, really sinister.
Well, it's all about small town corruption when you look about it. And and you can make it a nice equation, speaking of Orson Welles, to Magnificent Emerson's, Ruth Tarkington's book. So, but you know, the film does end up on a really nice note, and I think that's what we really love about it, for especially at this time of year when, you know, the community comes together, even though George would probably have gotten arrested because there was still malfeasance going on.
And he takes even more of their money away from them.
Really? I mean, and how long ago you know, we can get very cynical here. But the
even
fact
even the maid lady has to come and give her money out of her jar.
Right. So, but you know, we all remember the ending with Zuzu, Kathy Grimes, and it's here is when that little bell rings.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. Attaboy, Clarence.
You know, one of the other parts that I love about the character and Jimmy Stewart playing it is that this is a grown man as a mess, you know, which is not an archetype that you saw a lot in those types of movies. I mean, he is he comes home, he runs upstairs, hates the house, he loves, you know, all through the movie, he is just an emotional mess.
Maybe it's that he is. I mean, for some reason, the strange thought came into my mind. If Bedford Falls was South Boston, Whitey Bulger would have knocked off George Bailey a long time ago.
Well, think about Mr. Potter. He is not punished for his crime, which again was got by the censors, which was very unusual at the time. But he's very much a big fish in a small pond. You know, and so that's something to always to consider. But the true sad thing about It's a Wonderful Life right now, for me anyways, is that there's a sequel being planned.
Oh.
All right.
Who's doing it?
It's being done by a production company that has hired Kathy Grimes, who played Zuzu.
Oh, boy.
Zuzu is going to play an angel who comes back and to the great-grandson of George Bailey, who is a bad person, and it's going to teach him what life would be like if he didn't exist.
All right, well, we're just going to pretend Garen didn't say that. How's that? Garen Daly, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Film critic and the director and producer of the forthcoming documentary, The Orson Welles Complex. Great to see you. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Peter Katsas.
And I'm almost convinced.
Almost.
Not
He's getting
quite.
There.
Well, we'll do that off air.
All right. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. I'll be back tomorrow with Callie Crossley. We'll see you then on WGBH.